Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials
Science. Hi, this is Dave Cornielsen, and you are listening to the web version of STEM Spots. With me in the studio today is Lauren Jones, who's the clinic director, and Kim Ireland, who's the clinical supervisor in speech pathology for the Speech and Hearing Clinic here at Missouri State University. Thanks for stopping by, guys.
Happy to be here.
Thanks for having us.
And today we're going to talk about a number of things. But to get us started, Lauren, can you talk about the goals and aims for the clinic at Missouri State University?
The clinic serves as a clinical practicum site for the three graduate programs in our department, and that would be audiology, speech-language pathology, and education of the deaf and hard of hearing. So we meet the needs of the community while also educating our students.
So when you say meet the needs of the community, does that mean anybody can come in? And do you need a doctor referral or a diagnosed issue before you actually come?
Anyone can come. They do not need a physician referral, though some of our services do have waiting lists. And we do diagnostic services as well, so we can determine if anyone needs our services.
So can you tell me a little bit about what the age distribution is? Is it all over the map?
We really have a wide range of ages. We have little ones that attend speech therapy and our education of the deaf and hard of hearing preschool. And then for audiology, again, we've got a lifespan there, although our services probably gear towards adults for audiology, but we have pediatrics as well.
So, Kim, you supervise students in these programs. So talk about the kinds of programs and what kinds of treatment people would receive within them.
I am with the speech-language pathology program, and the students, at the conclusion of this, they are going to be speech-language pathologist certified. We also have the audiology program, and we have the educators of the deaf and hard of hearing. By the end of this program, they are all going to be ready to go out and practice in the real world in their professions. They are getting a bachelor's degree in speech-language pathology, which I believe is 23 hours in speech-language pathology. And they may have a little bit of where they assist a speech-language pathologist. And they also have 25 observation hours where they observe sessions.
Now, Lauren, you mentioned waiting lists. So, Kim, are there actually enough students in this field? Or is there a shortage of practitioners right now?
There is a shortage in the schools, especially the rural schools. There's a shortage there. More of the rural medical settings, skilled nursing facilities often have to share speech-language pathologists. There is definitely a need.
So, of course, since February or so, things have changed dramatically in the United States, impacting all of us. I know my job's been impacted greatly, and I'm probably assuming that you guys have had a response too. Lauren, talk about the clinic and what you've had to change and the responses that you've had to enable in order to deal with the COVID situation in the U.S. right now.
Our challenge was to determine how to adapt the services that all three disciplines provide, and of course the services are all very different, so the adaptations are different as well. And then of course we're still trying to meet the educational needs for our students that need clock hours in order to graduate and become certified.
Now, are you getting guidance from a national level? Are there mandates given to you, or are you making things up yourself as you go?
We do have accrediting and certifying bodies for all three programs, and they offer guidance, but not really a reduction in any of the requirements, just accommodations on how we can meet some of the requirements. So, for example, for speech therapy, we didn't get to reduce the hours that our students needed, but we were able on teleservices to have students collaborate on those appointments.
Do you think there's been a negative impact as to treatment of patients in this respect, especially when it comes to, for example, audiology?
Most of the time for audiology, they would need to come in the clinic. We're able to provide some consultative services via telehealth for audiology. So, for example, if a patient were struggling, they have a Bluetooth connection on their hearing aid that connects to their phone, and they just want some guidance on how to repair that issue, you know, we can offer some consultation. We can get them in touch with the manufacturer of the hearing aid. But most of the time, they need to come in order to be in our booths and be tested. And then the measurements that are taken once they're fit with the hearing aids really need to happen in person most of the time. So the struggle there was just changing our processes in many cases, staggering appointments and cleaning in different ways, and not having them come in the waiting room. So, you know, often what you're seeing at medical clinics around town, just upping our screening process, upping our protective equipment, staggering appointments so that it's safe.
Now, Kim, for the educational component, how have things changed for the students?
As Lauren said, students had to get 400 clock hours in speech-language pathology. They did not minimize those. After we left for spring break, students still needed those clock hours, but we weren't at a point where we could provide teleservices yet. So what they did instead is they went online and they saw clips of simulated patients or real patients, and they could observe, they could make a diagnose and then make a treatment plan for those patients, and then they would confer with their clinical supervisor and gain clock hours for those. They weren't as many clock hours as they would typically get, and they could only get 75 out of the 400 doing it that way. And a lot of our students did get at the 75. They got maxed out at the 75. But over the summer, then we were able to provide telehealth services, and those count towards above the 75, so the 325 hours.
Okay, Kim, now you're a clinician, and of course you're concerned with actually giving treatment, but it seems like there probably are people in audiology and speech pathology academicians who are actually looking at this, trying to study the efficacy, for example, of the tele-sessions versus in-person, published journal articles perhaps, and look at that sort of thing. Do you know of any studies that are going along those general lines? Kim?
There is a lot of discussion in our weekly newsletter or in our monthly newsletters from the American Speech Language Hearing Association. There's a lot of discussion, so I imagine there is a lot going on behind the scenes that we'll learn more about.
But it would seem there would have to be some studies going on, probably double-blinded or something, so people's own biases wouldn't get filtered in to the actual work. I'd be fascinated in learning about that sort of thing. Of course, how about the students? What is their feedback? Are they feeling comfortable with doing things this way?
Yeah, a lot of them didn't really get the opportunity to do telepractice before. They didn't think that they would get the opportunity in our program. Now that they've gotten that opportunity, I heard many of them have told me that they're amazed by how much they enjoy it, how much they get to see in the client's home, in the client's life. It's gone really well. They seem to really enjoy it, and we're getting some positive feedback preparing them for possibly this could be their career is teletherapy.
So is this opening up a previously unexplored avenue, or is this just widening the opening for something that was already there so that it can be exploited in the future?
It's going to become bigger, definitely more important.
So I wonder a little bit about what people would think. I mean, it seems like to me at least that some people would say, I would rather go to the clinic, but I guess I have to do tele-sessions instead. But could it actually become the go-to method in some cases?
I know. In the rural areas especially, the internet connection was a challenge. There was a delay on the end of the client or the therapist. And I think that there's been that's gotten a lot better. People have updated their computers. I've updated my home office so that we have that better internet connection. And I think that that is going to really make this teleservices take off. There'll always be in-person services. There are just some disorders that are better suited for in-person services. But teleservices, it's here to stay.
So, of course, just recently we've seen more and more tech companies saying things like, well, we're going to get rid of all our brick and mortar companies and stores, and everybody will just work from home, and it will become this entire new way of doing things. Do you say that could actually, or do you think that could actually happen in this particular case where people would become speech pathologists and work from the comfort of their own home exclusively? Is that likely or possible?
I think, there are telehealth companies out there. They've been in existence for many years that the therapists solely provide teletherapy. But I think what we might see is more of a blend, and maybe there will still, I think there will still be a need for in-person services, but we might be able to see more flexible scheduling come out of this, where maybe if the client is driving an hour for their service, they do that one time a week instead of twice a week, and their second session is via teletherapy. So I could see more hybrid approaches coming out of this. I'm hoping for us that would be part of it, but of course we're bound by what our certifying bodies say for our students. So them relaxing some of the requirements on telehealth, would determine if we're able to keep this as part of our educational programming.
So, Kim, obviously, I don't really know that much about audiology or speech pathology, although, I am a physicist, so I do know a little bit about it. But I always thought that at least in certain cases, especially, for example, in speech pathology, that there needed to be hands-on, as it were, that people needed to be able to be touched and actually in person to be able to get the full measure of treatment. Is that true? Are there going to be situations where there are going to be losses because of the way things are done in that context?
There are certainly disorders where it would be better. Swallowing, for example, that would be something where you would want to be able to touch the client or be there for safety issues. Also, our little ones, sometimes they can't sit at a computer. But there's so many other disorders. Written language, it's been wonderful for written language. Voice disorders and... Help me out, Lauren. I'm trying to think of the other ones.
Yeah, I might add, too, that you're able to get a really close-up view of your articulators. You wouldn't normally get maybe as close to an individual as you would to a camera. And in order to provide placement instruction for articulation, you can get quite close to that camera so they can see where your tongue is. They can see how you're moving your articulators. They can have a really nice full-face view for certain kinds of work. So I think in some ways there are benefits of having that view.
And it's great quality.
Now, Lauren, you and I had already talked about this a little bit, that even though there's technological challenges, for example, with the quality of somebody's internet connection, of course, there's an ease in some other restrictions which would be related to transportation, for example. So talk a little bit about that.
Well, if people are driving and parking, sometimes that's a barrier. And getting just walking down the hall to where your computer is can sometimes reduce some of that stress and anxiety for, older individuals who maybe don't want to get out as much, or even younger individuals who have anxiety about coming into social situations. It could be well suited to that. We also had a number of individuals over the summer who took trips with their RV, and they were able to take us with them. And so uninterrupted services, I see, is another benefit of the telehealth model, so that we don't get as many cancellations maybe. And we've got a lot of busy families who have multiple things to schedule around, so sometimes this fits better in their lifestyles.
So let's think about some of these things, Lauren and Kim, both. For example, coupling of these kinds of issues to other sorts of problems. So, for example, audiology, obviously, you have at least a lot of this prevalent in older people, and older people are less ambulatory. So how would this play into the fact that, for example, they're less able to negotiate stairs on average and that sort of thing? How does that play out?
Yeah, it definitely has. And just drive time, driving into Springfield and parking, it's much shorter to sit at your computer, just walking towards your computer and sitting there. So, there's been a lot of things that benefits for sure.
And with children, if they've got developmental delays, they're often attending more than one kind of therapy. So again, it's just maybe it can fit better into their schedule if they're not being shuttled around to three different clinics.
And just the parent education. Parents are right there with their child. Whenever we did therapy in person, typically the parent would be in the waiting room or they might be in the observation room. But now they're with their child sitting at that computer. So the clinician, the student, can actually educate the parent on strategies that they can use with the child all the time. there's a lot more generalization.
So now when you think about the way this actually changes things, now when you have with children, for example, and you have their parents there in the telesession with them, and you see the positives from that, is this going to change the way perhaps you look at when they come into the clinic? Because typically in the past, you think about parents not going back with their children when they're treated for certain kinds of things, so that the parents aren't layering on their own expectations and their fears and their worries of how things are going when the professional is trying to diagnose and treat. So how do you see that playing out with the way you're seeing this be enhanced in the telesessions? How could that play out in the future in the way you do your clinical work also?
And we've always done that to some extent, where we bring the parent back for education. In teletherapy, the parent is there primarily just to help the kid to stay in front of the computer. But it's definitely something that we look at, that maybe one client might be good for teletherapy, one might be good for in-person, or we could do a blend, as Lauren said.
So I'm not really sure how you handle some of this kind of stuff. I mean, when you do the clinic visits, do you actually have a faculty member in there with the student while the student is actually doing the work? Is that what happens? I mean, I'm not sure. And so now with the telesession, what will you do? Will you actually be in the video process with them, or will you just be taking their video and watching it for yourself later? How does that work out?
I have to supervise in the moment, but sometimes I have two sessions going on at once. So typically in the clinic, I have a monitor on where I'm watching one session in one room and then another session in the other room, and I'm listening on each one. I am supposed to supervise at least 25 to 50% of the overall sessions. So what I'm doing now is I am observing one day, one session a week, and then the other day I'm observing another session. And then students have my information, my cell phone number, where they can contact me. And actually, teletherapy has worked out better because we can have a chat function on Zoom, and we can talk to the clinician and they can try things in the moment, which is what we didn't have in the clinic in person.
Well, one of the things we've noticed for ourselves is that when we're doing our Zoom lectures, we're paying so close attention to the Zoom and to doing our lecture that we're not able to pay very close attention to the chats, and things are getting biased. And so, of course, in some of our larger classes, we have a student, some sort of a graduate assistant, who actually does nothing but watch the chat and then call attention to the faculty member. Are you guys doing something like that? Do you have a setup where you can actually make sure that you're catching everything you need to?
Well, one of the nice things is that our ASHA, our body, the American Speech Language Hearing Association, they said that we could group students and that they could count the
clock
hours.
So one of them helps the other.
So there is one person in charge of chat, and the other is actually directing the activity.
So now, Lauren, has this changed your way of looking at, for example, professional development? I'm sure the people in the clinic have to do continuing education. And are you thinking about actually pushing them in the direction where they'll be doing most of their continuing education in this sort of work so that they can get better at the telesessions?
I think they've all sought that out on their own. We get to do our continuing ed in areas that are our specialties. But I think everyone has chosen to, myself included, focus a lot of my continuing ed on service delivery via teletherapy. The biggest challenge is just adapting activities and learning fun and creative ways to do that. And SLPs are really creative people, I think, and it's been fun to see what SLPs serving different populations have done. There's a lot of SLPs doing green screen backgrounds now to keep little ones engaged, putting different backgrounds on. So seeing how to adapt the activities, I think, is kind of the apprehensive part at first, but then of course it ends up leading you to things that you couldn't do in person.
So Kim and Lauren, of course, this makes me think about people engaging psychologically. And I'm not talking about some sort of a problem that they might have, but just the general psychological engagement with your treatment. It's not like something where you go in and you get a blood test and somebody hands you some medicine. This is different. And so do you think that people's ability to engage with their own treatment, and so that they benefit more, that maybe it's actually going to be enhanced by these methods in the future?
Yeah, with therapy, there is always a buy-in from the client, and just they're in their natural environment. So we see, especially with our adults, they have the objects that they use there. If they're working on labeling those objects, they have them with them. And with children, the parents are there. They're fun and engaging activities that if you are excited, if the background stimulate language, you're going to get better results.
Well, that's interesting. So we can say that instead of it being that over the last 6 months it's just been one large negative, there's actually, would you say, positive feedback that's coming out of all of this, that there's a positive aspect?
There's been a lot of positive feedback regarding this from the students, from our clients. A lot of them, when we were thinking about, are we going to do face-to-face therapy or are we going to do teletherapy, a lot of them just said off the bat that they wanted to continue teletherapy, just that it was easier for them to do it, especially like right after school or with their other appointments or with work schedules.
Lauren, please tell us how people can avail themselves of the programs you offer.
They just need to contact the clinic directly. As you said, we don't require physician referrals for our services. Our speech therapy services are at no fee, and our audiology evaluation services are also at no fee. We do charge for hearing aids. They can contact the clinic or get on our website, our MSU website, and find our information, and we'll walk them through the intake process.
But there might be a waiting list.
For some of our services, there are, and that's largely because we go by the academic calendar. We keep our students with the same clients for a semester, so our turnover is usually when we have a new semester start.
But I really appreciate so much both of you stopping by. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And once again, this is Dave Cornelison for STEM Spots, signing off.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.